It's a pleasure to introduce Alberto Valenotto, visiting us from Fermilab. He's worked on a lot of very interesting topics, ranging from inflation to dark matter physics to cross correlation of large scale structures with large scale structures.
Different large scales.
Different ranges of large scale structures. Give you Alberto Valenotto.
Thank you very much. It's great to be here, and thank you very much for the show.
Thank you very much for the invitation. So I'm going to start just briefly, very briefly reviewing the evidence for dark matter, and by saying that the evidence for dark matter is quite a lot, has been growing over the time, starting with cluster dynamics. This goes all the way back to
through galaxy
rotations curve that that shows a different behavior than what you would expect just looking at luminous matter, all the way through Big Bang nucleosynthesis with gammas and company. Gravitational lensing, this is, I'm going to show later a bigger picture. This is a picture from a Castle catalog where you see a quasar and four other quasars
that are actually the same image. These are images of the same quasar. If you take the spectra, they have exactly the same spectra.
The only difference is that the path length between these images, you can time it, is 400 days. So they have a different impact, 400 days length. Cosmic microwave background, and lastly, the Wooden cluster. So now, dark matter. There are different people approach the question of dark matter in different ways. One way, obviously, is asking what is dark matter made of. A second question is how was dark matter distributed initially? And by initially, we can think of, well, the earliest data are CP data, but why are they distributed that way? How is dark matter distributed now? And how this distribution affects what we observe. So the first set of questions goes into quark cross physics. The second one goes into inflation. The third one goes into the study of large scale structure. And the fourth, I would say 3A, goes into gravitational lensing. So for some strange random fluctuation at the beginning of my career, I dealt in one way or the other with all these questions. And except for inflation that I'm not talking about today, I'm going to tell you a little bit of the other three fields. So I'll start with particle astrophysics. And the question is, what is dark matter made of? And from an experimentalist point of view, let's look for dark matter. Let's try to find it and figure out what it's made of. There are three different experimental techniques: direct detection, collider searches. The idea behind direct detection is to measure the recoil energy of a weak nucleus collision. There are potential problems or difficulties. There, the first one is background, so you need to go deep underground. The second one is that there are very low interaction rates. In particular, if I say that the dark matter density in this room is 0.3 GeV per centimeter cubed, that doesn't make a lot of sense, I guess, to people. But if I say that if I take a wind candidate of about 100 or 200 GeV and I look at a meter cubed, then there are like a few thousand of these wimps in this meter cube. That gives us a feeling for how little dense this matter is. And together with the fact that the interactions are on the weak scale, this tells you that this weak, very low interaction rate require very large volumes and costs for this experiment to work and get a signal. So in direct detection, this is second class of experiment. Here, the idea is to detect, try to detect a product of dark matter and inflation. So Whereas before, in the director session case, you are in the lab, so you control your background. In this case, you can't. There are a bunch of, there are four classes of different products that we are looking at, electron and positron, and the protons, gammas, and neutrinos. So, and there are several experiments for each. Panera released data on electron, positron, and antiprotons that has been in the news for the last year or so. It generated, I guess, like more than 300 papers in about 6 months trying to explain the signal. Then we have Fermi, which is taking data on gammas and also on electron and positron. The reason why Fermi is taking, you know, is good at doing electron and positron is because it's measuring gammas through pair production, so it's also very good at measuring electron and positrons. Then we have atmospheric Cherenkov telescope, like HESS, MAGIC, and Veritas. Now, neutrinos. For neutrinos, we have Antares. So, neutrino telescope use the Earth as a shield against atmospheric muons, and they look at muons that go through the Earth, sorry, they look at neutrinos as go through the Earth, then they go through the detector, and at that point they convert into muons. So they look at the muon track in there. So we have Antares in the Mediterranean Sea, and then we have Ice Cube in the South Pole. So as I was saying before, here the drawbacks are astrophysical uncertainties. The fact that you don't really know the injection spectrum and the propagation method, mechanism, especially for charged particles. So in this respect, for instance, gammas and neutrinos are cleaner than antiprotons and electron positrons. The third class is collider searches. And here the idea is that no matter what is the extension of the standard model that you build to have your favorite dark matter candidate, this gives predictions also for collider signatures. So in principle, you can look for these signatures at the Tevatron ELHC. Okay, so that was the experiment. Here's the theory. When you build a model, you can either go from the theory to the data or vice versa. If you go from the theory to the data, you build your extension of the standard model with a dark matter candidate that does not violate any of the constraints from the data that you already have. And possibly, hopefully, you predict new observational signature. If you want to go the other way around, from the data to the theory, then you build your theoretical model around data, and that's what happened lately with Panel, Fermi, and so on. And still, you hope to have predictions for some signature that have not been observed yet, so that you can possibly distinguish your model from some other model. Now, I'm going to focus first on from the theory to the data. So when you do that, your candidate always have to satisfy cosmological constraint. It needs to be weakly interacting. If it's not weakly interacting, if it's strongly interacting, then it stays in equilibrium too much too long period of time, and so you end up having a relative density that is too low. It needs to be stable or metastable, meaning that the lifetime of your particles need to be at least the lifetime of the universe. It needs to be cold, massive, and slow because it needs to form structure that we see now. It needs to be neutral. There are strong bounds from like neutron stars, for instance, on that. And it needs to be consistent with BBM. Now, for instance, the first candidate that people thought that initially were, well, made of stuff that we already know, baryons and neutrinos. Like baryons, matches, for instance, like planets, things that we don't see, but we know that they are there. And neutrinos, we know that they have mass. The question is whether they could be the dark matter. Now, these guys were ruled out, baryons, because they're inconsistent with BBM, CFDM, baryon oscillation, and microlensing. And neutrinos are ruled out because to have neutrino, dark matter made of neutrino, you need about 30 eV for some of the masses of the neutrino, which is way too much. And neutrinos so massive, they would erase structure on a small scale, and that's inconsistent with what we observe.
So why aren't they capping?
Sorry?
Why aren't neutrinos capping?
Well, they have mass.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. I have a quick question about the top point. Mm-hmm. Do you know why did people go and look for microlensing in the 80s given BBM? I mean,
oh, because microlensing is still a way to detect planets. So if you want to detect exosolar planets, you do that through microlensing.
But I got the impression that at least when they started, they really thought they were going to find baryonic dark matter. And I almost wondered, was there some argument about why BBM didn't rule that out? Or
I think there are these models that are homogeneous BBM.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
For example, you have primordial black holes that doesn't affect it. Mm-hmm. I think that not as extreme as black holes.
Okay.
So still, even applying those constraints, we have a lot of candidate for this job. And since I wanted to have my own candidate, I work on one specific class of model, which is Kaluza-Klein. Kaluza-Klein, six-dimensional Kaluza-Klein model. Now it turns out that the lightest Kaluza-Klein particle does not overcross the universe, is stable. It's called a massive neutral and does not screw up BBM. So at least it's not ruled out. Now, whenever you consider indirect detection of gammas, you have two contributions with the gamma you're measuring. The first contribution is the continuum spec, when it's coming from gammas from quark or gauge boson fragmentation, mostly biomass, so it's quite soft. The second contribution is coming from finite state radiation from charged leptons, and that depends on how your dark matter candidate is going to decay. This continuous spectrum is almost featureless, but it has a sharp cutoff at low impacts. Now, the real smoking gun is coming from light. So you can have two imps going into a photon and something else. The something else can be a gamma, can be a Z, can be, we'll see that it can be also something else that I'm going to talk in a minute. In that case, the coming out gamma has a very sharp defined, it's a very sharp defined energy, just given by this formula. So if these lines are detected, this is really a smoking gun for dark matter. Fermi is right now putting limits on these lines, but they are way above what the cross section that we have, right? For most models. Okay, so I compare 5 and 6 dimensional Kaluza-Klein models. So in the 5 dimensional case, you need to compactify the circle. In the 6 dimensional case, you can compactify them in different ways. The way we do it is by identifying opposite angles of a square. In the 5 dimensional case, KK modes are identified by one single index. On the other hand, which is the number of excitations you have in the extra dimension. In the other case, you have two indices. Now, in both cases, the AKP, so the lightest Kaluza-Klein particle, which is your our dark matter candidate, is the partner of the hypercharged gauge boson. Now, an interesting thing is that in the 5-dimensional case, the FKP is more lepton friendly than in the 6-dimensional case, meaning that the branching ratio into leptons for the 5-dimensional KK is about 6%, 20, 20, 24 electron muons and taus. And that's the reason why this is very good for Pamela, because Pamela has this excess in positrons. Now, in the 5-dimensional case, the FKP can reach a mass of about 1 TeV. In the other case, it's a little bit lighter. It's about 450.
Yes. Two questions. One is, could you give a motivation as to why 60 is a fine dark matter? You just kind of said this is just a model, that's fine. But is there anything more to it? Like, what about this model actually do you think is compelling or interesting? Or
Or is it just one of the possibilities and you're just exploring it? Or?
It's one very interesting possibility. And as I will show in a minute, actually working on this tells us also a lot about higher dimensional models as well. I'm going to show your conclusion in two slides about the fact that six-dimensional tells you something also about seven. I mean, doing this work, we figure out stuff also about seventh or higher dimensional.
That kind of answers another one of my questions. So you think of these as honest to God extra dimensions, not right. You think of these as honest to God real extra dimensions, not an analog of some sort of ADS-CFD sort of way.
No.
Honest to God extra dimensions. And do you have any statement about the flavor structure of these models because of the problems that these extra dimensional models are starting to experience with flavor constraints people are kind of doing?
No.
All right.
I'm not aware of that problem. Is there an intuitive way to see the difference between the one being left hand friendly and the other?
Because sorry?
Between the left hand
yes.
friendly and the other one is not? Because they're
it depends on the scattering. I mean, the scattering is mostly S wave. So
it's the,
in one case, it's much easier than the other. So, and here I'm addressing your question. In the case of 5D, the tower and the masses, bringing by this formula, in the six-dimensional case, you have this formula over here. Now, the interesting thing is that if you calculate like the M10 here is your LTP, but you can show that the you can show that two M10 have a mass that is higher than a M11. And the reason is because 1 squared plus 1 squared gives you 2 instead of 4. So in this case, and higher dimensional case as well, the AKP can perannihilate into other KK particles. So in models with 2 or more UET, the AKP can be schematically allowed perannihilate into KK particles, other KK particles, and gamma. And these extra lines are well separated from the Z gamma and gamma gamma lines, and potentially they carry information about the extra dimensions. So spectroscopy of UED is how we call it, depending on whether your perception and continuum are favorable. And that depends on the number of extra dimensions, how you compactify them, and so on and so forth. So here I'm showing the two continuum for the five-dimensional case and the six-dimensional case. As I said before, the five-dimensional case decays more into leptons, and you see it here where the spectrum is harder than in this case, and this is due to the final state radiation. Now, this is the really interesting part. This is the six-dimensional KK. So, in this case, the LKP can decay into gamma gamma, Z gamma, and you have these two lines, and a B11 plus a gamma, which is well separated from the other two. Now, the dashed curve are the infinite resolution curves. So, what you would see if you had a detector with an infinite energy resolution, solid line is with an energy resolution of 10%, which is the one Fermi has. So even with an energy resolution that is as low as 10%, you would be able to distinguish this bump from these two. That was the case for 250 GeV. This is the case for 450 GeV. You still have the bump over here in B11. Now, the five-dimensional case, so this is admittedly a fine example of fine-tuning. And the reason is that I picked this 300 GeV not randomly. This is the value that allows you to see the three lines. And an energy resolution of 0.5%, which is one order of magnitude at least better than Fermi. So if all these conditions are satisfied at the same time, you would be able to see a gamma-gamma line, a z-gamma line, and a higgs-gamma. So in that case, you would be able to measure the higgs.
So all this, I guess, is these things have to have lifetimes that are the whole time, mm-hmm. and that comes naturally out of the models, doesn't it?
Those are stable, they're protected by KP-PAT.
All of them are?
Yeah.
Even the higher ones?
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, no, the higher ones, no.
Well, I guess what I'm wondering is why is this different paper? Is it obvious why it's different from, say, supersymmetry, where you have more massive supersymmetry?
In supersymmetry, you have R quality that is, you know, protecting, I mean, that giving you your LSP.
Sure, but...
And here you have KP parity.
You could then have more massive particles decay to that,
mm-hmm.
which would, in principle, produce lines, but, I mean, I guess I haven't looked at the lifetimes, but I presume all that happens in the early universe. Were sort of left with the LSP
mm-hmm.
pretty early on.
So you're saying that the B11 would decay into B10s again. That's also possible.
Okay.
Yeah, sure.
So are these signatures and these lines really strongly dependent on the low mass scales you have here? You have mm-hmm. these things.
Yeah.
So if they're like a TV or 2 TV, instead I'll just wash away.
Yeah, you wouldn't see them. They would merge together, and potentially, if you had an infinite resolution kind of detector, you would see them.
Yeah.
But this is already stretching it a lot. I mean, already saying that 0.5% energy resolution. Bergstrom did it in his first paper on KK, five-dimensional KK lines. But if you talk to people that are measuring this thing, I'm not sure that they will ever reach this kind of precision.
These very light mass scales are very worrisome for what? Already known strong constraints on anything that couples to quarks. So how do these things couple to quarks? What's the Lagrangian term?
That's a good question.
Why
are you saying that they're worrisome?
Just any sort of flavor change.
There's no flavor change.
There's no flavor effects in this at all.
This KK parity, it's just like R parity.
So it just completely protects it?
Yeah, it protects it. And as long as you don't put higher dimension off it, it's violated.
Which should be
there in effective theory. But then that's how you get away.
So there is no constraint whatsoever on these guys being... we still think there's a constraint.
Yeah, it's like... in this range, a few hundred dB electric distance.
So it's safe from that.
Yeah.
Okay, so the bottom line for here is that KK extension of the standard model with more than one extra dimension exhibit extra lines well separated from gamma. Whether you will be able to measure these lines or not depends on the right combination of continuum and cross-section, which depends on the specific model you're considering. This is definitely not the only model that is characterized by a two-bump feature. The Higgs in space that came out a few days ago by some collaborators of mine also shows this two-bump feature. Another one is the intermediate dark matter. And finally, detection of a single bump and no drop-off could also hint toward the beam for the scenario.
So what's the difference? So in your last plot, you had the Higgs... Also, and what's the difference between this model that came out just a few days ago? And is this not the same signature, basically?
I don't think that we are looking at the same particle physics.
Right, it's not the same, but I mean the signature is H gamma,
mm-hmm.
dark matter, I think.
Yeah. Okay, in that sense, it's the same. I don't remember. Does the gamma Z and gamma gamma line merge in the
case? I don't know.
Okay. Okay, so that was from the theory to the data. Now we go from the data to the theory. And we are looking at the interplay of different experimental techniques. So whenever you extend your Lagrangian to include the dark matter candidate, automatically your theoretical predictions for these three classes of experiment are not independent anymore. For indirect detection, you have indirect detection of many different things. Many different products, and even the same product, like photons, you're looking at them on different wavelengths. So this is the so-called multi-messenger approach. What I looked at is the interplay between direct detection and collider switches. In this case, the same processes contribute to both. So the results are expected to be correlated. Now, in this case, with the extension of the standard model we're considering is supersymmetry. With supersymmetry, you have R parity that allows you to have a stable candidate, which is the supersymmetric, lightest supersymmetric particle. Now, you have this host of possible candidates, but both are ruled out. Charginos and Zlatkons are ruled out because they are charged. Neutrinos are ruled out by direct detection. Gluino and Swarm are not even considered because they interact strongly. And the usual suspects are normally intraginos. So what we did here was the following. We took models, we scanned over MSSM space, and we took models that are consistent with WMAP relic, with the WMAP relic density, and that would give a 3-sigma discovery of the Higgs boson and temperature. So all these points are point models that use a 3-sigma discovery of the temperature. And we plotted it in this parameter space with mass of the neutrino and nucleon wind scattering cross section, which is the mass where the space where constraints from direct detection are normally plotted. So CDMS was here in 2007 and is digging down. And what this is telling you is that all these models are ruled out. So, because CDMS in 2007, 2008, I'm not talking about what's going to happen next, maybe. But so far, all these models were ruled out. So there is a strong interplay between these. This is the same situation, but for the LHC. And by the way, we had to the scan we did was so big that once we made these plots, we were not able to post them to the archive because they were too big. So we had to rebuild the whole thing. And here you're not seeing all the models, you see them rebuilt. This is the situation for the LHC. One thing that I have to point out is that this analysis depends on the channel we are looking at for your provider search. So in this case, we are looking at the backup channel.
Not just the channel, but the cuts and how you're defining the experimental sensitivity.
Mm-hmm.
None of that's appearing on your plot.
Right.
So, cool. What is the sensitivity? I mean, how are you defining this 3-sigma discovery exactly?
What I did was to go to the people at CDF and ask them what they were, their limits and constraints on that. Black box that allowed me to make a scan in supersymmetric parameter space and implement their signatures.
So they have also, so they're just giving you a cross section?
They give me a mass and a cross section.
And that's what they're bounding.
Mm-hmm. And the same thing we did here, but this is for discovery of a Charginum in a pre-lepton channel. So in this case, this addresses also your question. In this case, we didn't have this nice black box, so I had to build my own black box. And it's not a black box because I built it myself. So in that case, I know exactly what I did was to come here and use first soft SUSY to build a particle spectrum from the parameters. Then to that, I attached Prospino to calculate actually the cross sections and SDK to calculate break duration. So I had a way to figure out this whole process, this whole chain of decays. And here is the same, we play the same game. The black points are points that are consistent with WMAC relic density. The magenta points are points that have a relic density that is smaller or equal to one of WMAP, so they don't overflow the universe. They are still allowed, but they are not. You need something else to make up for the whole relic density.
And that goes into the calculation of the direct detection limits.
Yes.
Whatever density you count.
Yes, yes, you have, of course, you have to scale it properly. Okay, so this project, these last two projects were a nice format, but if you want to efficiently constrain MSSM parameter space using all available data from colliders in direct and direct detection, the best tools are definitely Monte Carlo map of chain, because the parameter space is so big that, I mean, just doing random scan is not good enough. So, in fact, I'm working right now with Tim and Plan, in Heidelberg, Dan Cooper at Fermilab, and Michael Rau at Karlsruhe to build this this code that is called the Sweeper. That, by the way, is not the only code that's going to do that, but it's our own code. The amount of experimental data becoming available makes these days the most exciting days for parameter physics. One example for that is that Magnetic satellites. So, if you make a simulation of a galaxy formation, you end up having all these dark matter clouds, and or dark matter subtables, if you want. Now, not as many as the one predicted have been observed. And the reason for this, that may be many, one is the fact that, first of all, it's a top life to be a wind clump seeking attention, in the sense that you are a small subtalo, your potential well is not very deep, so your escape velocity is pretty high, pretty low. So you are trying to attract baryons, attract them, cool them down so that you can ignite them and condense them into stars. But these damn stars at some point have the bad habit of exploding. So when they explode, they drive out all the baryons, or most of the baryons that you're creating them. So it's really difficult to see these dark matter clouds. Now, given a reasonable cross section for dark matter annihilation, however, they should become visible in the gamma ray sky, simply because the dark matter rings go into gamma gamma. So this is, for instance, a map of the square of the density integrated along the line of sight, and you see of the Via Lactea 2 simulation, and you see that these clouds all of a sudden become visible in your in the gamma ray sky. So, by the way, I should say that here there is no Sommer enhancement. So this is not assuming. This is assuming a vanilla kind of cross section for the dark matter annihilation. So this is a nice way for me to transit also from where I was before, which is particle astrophysics, to where I'm going now, which is large scale structure. So structure formed through gravitational collapse, starting from initial conditions that are consistent with the CMB. This is a nice.
Sorry, I didn't get the point that you mentioned dark matter satellites, and essentially we're going to be able to see them.
Yes. Well, given a reasonable cross section, I mean, if the annihilation cross section is 10 to the minus 32 centimeter squared, then maybe not. But if it's the 3.3 times 10 to the minus 26, which is normally assumed for.
But for the models that you discussed, are we going to be able to see this?
For the model that I discussed, that like the NKP, is our cross section out of the order of 10 to the minus 28. So it will take some integration time for Fermi, but potentially, yes. There is already a paper by Cooper and someone else claiming to reanalyze Fermi data. It's a very controversial paper, claiming that they reanalyze Fermi data and they already see dark matter signature. Now
that's at the center of the galaxy.
Right? That's at the center of the galaxy. And they have to assume a cross-section of at least 9 times 10 to the minus 26. So in that case, satellites will become visible very fast, very quickly. That paper maybe you would have for other instances as well.
So what makes an annihilation cross-section reasonable?
Sorry?
So what makes a cross-section reasonable?
Well, any cross-section is reasonable. Whether it's it needs to be of the weak scale kind of cross-section. I mean, but apart from that,
You need the right abundance of dark.
That's what I'm trying to say, yes. But it's also true that if you produce too little dark matter, you can always compensate with something else. The problem is really when you overflow the universe. That's the real. I mean, you cannot overflow the universe. That is bad. Okay, so simulation results are consistent with observational evidence for large scale structure surveys on large scales. Here we see the Sloan. And this is the Millennium simulation. And so the bottom line here is that we are looking at the universe through an inhomogeneous medium. And to see dark matter, well, first of all, cosmological perturbation theory provides a theoretical framework for prediction of the analysis of the properties of the dark matter field distribution. Now, being dark, we cannot really see dark matter. What we do to see dark matter is to use tracers, which is the idea that the more dark matter you have in some region of space, the more you would expect that there is also other stuff luminous that we see, so galaxies, quasars, clusters, or also neutral hydrogen, which would become visible, for instance, in a 21 centimeter survey carried out, or also in the Lyman forest. And also the CV temperature that is telling us the distribution of dark matter. The second way is to measure the distortion of images by the dark matter gravitational field. Now, these tracers allow to probe the dark matter field on different scales, and they are biased in different ways, meaning that the relation between how much other stuff you have to how much dark matter you have depends on what is the stuff you're looking at. One example of that is the large-scale 21 centimeter survey that we are considering at Fermi, where we are considering a survey at low redshift between redshift of zero and a redshift of four. This is not an epoch of reionization survey. It's a low redshift large-scale structure survey using a rectangular cylindrical radio telescope array, and this is thought to be a very cheap and competitive way to do dark energy measurement through PAO, bioacoustic oscillations, provided, and this is a big provided, that foreground subtraction is carried out at some point. Now, this has this is really a high potential for the future. What I did in this field was to calculate large scale bias of neutral hydrogen. So to do this, we built the neutral hydrogen mass function. And then we had to propagate it to higher redshift. To do that, we need two pieces of information. First of all, how much hydrogen you have in the universe. And this is not constrained almost at all by data. If you look at these error bars, the experimental constraint on this is are very small. And the second way is the second piece of information that we need was how this high neutral hydrogen. Yes.
So doesn't the Lyman Alpha forest give you a number for this?
For what?
For the neutral hydrogen colonies, please.
Since there's a data point that from.
But I mean, you would think it would be better, right? I don't know.
Yes, but
that's the reason why the error bars are reasonably small beyond redshift 2. And as you go there, you go to the ultraviolet and it gets very hard.
Okay, beyond the redshift 2, the error bars are, I think.
Yeah, they're becoming smaller.
So there you have to do it from space. Mm-hmm.
So the second piece of information is how this hydrogen, neutral hydrogen, is distributed among halos. And here what we did was to assume two limiting distribution, saying like, oh, maybe we can fix the number density of the halos and distribute hydrogen among those, or otherwise fix the halo mass and let the number density float and distribute the hydrogen that way. The truth is going to be somewhere in between. We are not claiming that this is the right way of, you know, pinpointing the evolution. It's a way of bracketing. So using Schettenbaum formalism, this is the analytical prediction that we had for the two different cases. Actually, you see them in here, in between. Model A, B, and C are different limiting behavior of the total fraction of neutral hydrogen that we assume. And then, using the same, using this same information, what we did was to paint neutral hydrogen on the Millennium simulation and measure on the Millennium simulation the bias to see whether it agrees with the prediction. And the agreement is pretty well. It is pretty good. It's not perfect. It's within 5%. But given the rough approximation that we did, we thought that was satisfactory.
If you do that, you make the implicit assumption that the neutral hydrogen is actually the same at high and at low redshift.
Sorry?
You make the implicit assumption that the neutral hydrogen that you see at higher redshift and at low redshift is the same.
Yes.
But there's only about a few percent of the total variance in the neutral hydrogen. And the neutral hydrogen might actually be cycled through, okay. In which case you could have a much more complicated remapping of the neutral hydrogen to your halos than you do in your paper, in which case you get a very different evolution of the bias as a function of redshift.
So I don't understand your point. Why do you say it's the same neutral hydrogen?
Now they just take this, what you showed in the first part, they take the amount of neutral hydrogen that's there,
yeah.
And then they paint it on the simulation,
right.
And allow a little bit of merging between the halos. But they put it once into the halos and then let it evolve.
Is that why you put it in the halos and let them evolve?
But I could.
No, I think we did it on different
slices. Yeah.
But you could make a model that at high redshift it's all in very small galaxies. It's used up, and afterwards there's gas cooling in big galaxies, and that's an over hydrogen that you see in low redshift. That would have a very different behavior from what you model. The reason why you get a tight evolution for all the models you consider is because you basically have only this evolution of the neutral hydrogen
that's
by
right.
A factor of two, and you have a very restricted range how you redistribute it over halos.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not so sure if that actually reflects of what we think what cooled gas does in halos.
Okay. Then we can talk more about that. So let's move to gravitational lensing. So looking at the sky from an inhomogeneous medium. So, okay, photons travel on geodesics. Geodesics are determined by the distribution of matter between the observer and the source. So here we see a pretty picture of a cluster with images, distorted images of galaxies in the background. This one is the one that I showed before with a quasar in between and the four images of the same quasar on the sides. So lensing always have a twofold role. It always adds noise to your measurement. And it does that because, first of all, it moves stuff around. Things are not where we see them, simply because it bends geodesics. That is what we call smoothing. And the second thing is magnification bias. So it's the fact that if you are making a magnitude limited survey, lensing, what it does is to either stretch or to focus bundles of geodesics, making your source brighter or dimmer than what it really is. So some of the objects that should be in your catalog are not going to be there, and some objects that should not be in your catalog are going to be there. Now, if you add some information, and I'm going to explain later how, you can also extract some information from here. Because if you more or less know, for instance, how is this lensing is acting as magnification by our smoothing, then you can figure out what is the lens. So you can figure out what is the distribution of matter that is actually responsible for this. Now, this is one example, is the Cosmos field. So here we see a full three-dimensional master reconstruction of Ives density surface. And now I'm going to talk about something that I did recently. The cross-correlation of the Lyman alpha forest and CMB lensing, where information in this case about, well, we have lensing here, and we have information coming from the Lyman alpha forest. So putting together the two is going to tell us something. So the Lyman alpha forest, for the people that don't know what it is, you have a quasar that is emitting light. Light travels through the universe, it gets redshifted. Every time light goes through a neutral hydrogen cloud, the light that is at the right frequency to cause a 1s2p transition gets scattered away in a way that should be proportional to the density of neutral hydrogen in that cloud. So you end up having a spectra like this with absorption lines, and those lines are a map of the overdensity. If you think that as much neutral hydrogen is there, then there is as much dark matter. So on large scales, on scales that are 1 megaparsec and above, you can actually think that the neutral hydrogen is tracing dark matter. And so the first observable that we consider is the fluctuation in the relative flux. And sorry, the first and second moment of that. Now, on the other side, CMB lensing. Lensing depends on the distribution between the, of matter between the observer and the source. Quadratic optimal estimator allows you the construction of CMB lensing, of the CMB lensing, sorry, convergence field. So the way you do this is that is you take CMB, you put it in the back, then you take a distribution of matter, and you build a lens of that, you put it in the front, you lens the CMB, and then you pretend that you don't know anything about the lens. You just have this lens CMB. You apply this quadratic optimal estimator, and you see if you can reconstruct the lens. So this is the distribution of matter that was responsible for lensing, and this is the reconstructed one. So it works pretty well. So first of all, does it make sense to cross-correlate these two observables? Kappa, which is the convergence fields responsible for CMB lensing, depends on the dark matter over density integrated along the line of sight. The flux is proportional to the matter fluctuation along the line of sight. And these two are roughly at the same range. So yes, it does make sense. And what can we learn from that? Well, first of all, we can have a handle on the Lyman alpha flux dark matter bias, which is something that we are still working on. And more interesting to me, we can try to use this cross-correlation as a tool to measure cosmological parameters and make tests. So we looked at two different correlators. The first one is the correlator of the convergence field with the integrated fluctuation in the flux along the line of sight. It is sensitive to intermediate to large scales, and it is this guy is telling you what fluctuation in the forest are responsible for the lensing of the CMB along the same line of sight. Now, the more interesting one for us was the correlator between the always the convergence field of CMB and the flux variance integrated along the line of sight. Now, this correlator is sensitive to intermediate to small scales. And it is sensitive to the enhanced growth of structure in overdense region, also known as small cap. So this is the following, and it's important. Get rid of this for a second. So Imagine that you have a large over density, and then you have small scale fluctuations in that large over density. These density fluctuations on small scales, they are going to grow faster because they are living in a patch of universe that is over, that is over dense. Okay, so this is small capital. That guy over there is measuring that, he's sensitive to that. And we'll see it in a minute.
So the flux is limited, the resolution of the flux function is limited by the number of rays or
We're considering every correlator is a correlator of one quasar with the same pixel of the CMB along the line, same line side.
Okay, so you, so the number of pixels are the same as the number of quasars?
Correct, because if you look at BOSS or Big BOSS, it is still like two orders of magnitude smaller than the number of pixels that Planck has. So it's very, it is possible to have like two quasars in the same big, in the same CMB pixel, but that would be even better for us. Because in that case, the noise you have is much smaller. I mean, you have twice the signal and only once the noise. Now, to get these two guys, it is just a matter of evaluating a couple of integrals, these integrals here. Now, the problem is that actually, if you want to know with what precision you can measure this thing, then you have to introduce the fact that both CMB and Lyman metropolitan are measured with a finite resolution. So you have to introduce window functions. And these window functions completely break the symmetry of the spherical symmetry of your problem. The reason for this is that whenever you look at a quasar, you are picking one specific direction in the sky. And the CMB is always orthogonal to that. Now, it took me a while to realize that actually a very clever series solution can be obtained going around that six-dimensional integral that I showed you before and recasting it at the product of six one-dimensional integral that, on a computer runs much faster.
Because this is like a Limber approximation, or is
No, it's a series approximation.
Series in what?
It's a series solution, and the way you do it.
What is the expansion parameter?
Sorry.
What is the expansion parameter?
You integrate over the angle. That integral you have to do it, but the problem is that then you have k's that are coupled, and that doesn't allow you to decouple the integral, the k in the integrals over k anymore. But then what you do is to expand that, that is a modified Bessel function,
yeah.
You expand it in series. And that series expansion allows to factorize all the integrals. So it's actually pretty nice. Because
you mean this is a spherical Bessel function that you're expanding, or is
it it's a modified Bessel function. But it's not spherical.
Okay.
It's not spherical because we broke the spherical symmetry problem. Okay, so these are the results for the correlator. This is BOSS and Planck. So we are correlating the BOSS sample with Planck. And we are turning off these two constants, which model the fluctuating Gunn-Peterson approximation. So. Because what I'm at least really interested in is the physics of structure formation. We are assuming the resolution for BOSS and for Planck. Now, the results are that this correlator becomes smaller for increasing redshift, and the reason is that you're probing regions where structure had less time to form. And obviously, they increase if you're increasing the length of the spectrum. That is because you have more information. This is for BOSS cross-correlated with ACPOR, which is a futuristic version of ACT, being able to measure polarization. Here we are turning on the IEGM. So in this case, the behavior with respect to redshift reverses. Same with ACT. Now, signal to noise. And this is where mode coupling comes in. So in this case, in the case of that direct couple, we have no mode coupling. And signal and noise, they're both two-point functions. So you don't have any, almost any evolution with respect to redshift. The slight evolution is simply due to the frequency window. In this case, on the other hand, you have more cutting. So in this case, your signal is actually a three-point function, but your the dominant term to the noise are two-point functions. So actually here, I understand it physically in the following sense. Long and short wavelength mode, first of all, they grow independently. But then they also grow because of mode coupling. So they grow even faster. But the noise is growing only independently. So the noise grows less than signal. And that is the reason why it's giving you this linear growth, almost linear growth with respect to redshift. Sorry, yes, with respect to redshift. Now, signal to noise are about 30 for delta f kappa and about 9.6 for delta f squared kappa for both cross-correlated with Planck. And it's going to be 75 and 24 if for Bos cross-correlated, for big Bos.
So what are Bos and big Bos?
Bos is the STS-TEP string, which is taking data right now. And it's going to take, in the end, 160,000 quasar spectra.
160,000?
Yeah, quasar spectra.
Quasar
spectra? Yeah, 160,000 line of sight. Big Bos is going to have a million.
Million
quasars. So when you did these plots, so how many quasars did you pin together? Or how did you do these plots?
These are for a single answer. This signal to noise for a single answer. Okay. Now the other interesting thing that I was talking with people at the LBL last week is that actually. So Bos is taking data right now, and ACT already covered Stripe 2. So we can actually do this measurement very quickly using ACT. And the signal to noise for ACT on Stripe 2 is probably of the order of 5. So this is already getting interesting. This is with the futuristic ACT point. Signal to noise goes to 50 and 20 for these two guys. Cross-correlated with Bos, cross-correlated with ACT-POL, and 213.50 by cross-correlating with Big Bos. Now, I want to say at least one more thing. So, caveats first. Numerical results currently do not take into account nonlinear effect due to gravitational collapse. The extension is straightforward. The signal is expected to increase. The signal to noise is hard to say. All results do not take into account the small scale effect due to IGM physics. And we are using Gaussian approximation to evaluate the correlated variance. I should say, actually, that this is not as bad. And this is not as bad either, because Lyman Forest is a high redshift, so the contribution from small scales is not that large. Plus, something else that maybe we can talk later with the people that are interested. Now, cosmological application neutrino masses. So this guy is sensitive to intermediate to small scales and to the power spectrum normalization. If you look at CMB, the power spectrum normalization, the sum of the neutrino masses are not independent. They are cross-correlated. So, well, we can use this observable to try to put limit on the neutrino masses. What we did was to assume three different values for the sum of the neutrino masses and n sigma and see how delta f square kappa behaves. And these are the results. So this is for Bos plus Planck. And this is for ACT-POL plus Big Bos.
So what is 1, 2, 3?
1, 2, 3 are these three points.
Okay. They're very different.
Yes. But you also see that the error are small. Okay, so the bottom line is that cross correlation between alpha forest and CMB lensing will be detectable with very near future data sets, because these two guys are actually taking data right now. It will allow to probe the lamina, how well the lamina flux traces dark matter, growth structure, matter power spectrum on intermediate to small scales, and scale-dependent modification of gravity, possibly. Because actually, since delta F square kappa is sensitive to intermediate to small scales, if you have modification of gravity that have modes growing at different rate for different wavelengths, you can actually use this to test those. And numerical simulation would be crucial for a better understanding. That's what we are doing right now. Okay, so I'm running out of time. I will just flash. How much time does it have?
Fine.
Okay. I will flash very quickly through a couple of things. Information from weak lensing type 1A supernovae. So, supernovae are beautiful firecrackers that we detect through image subtraction. And they are standardizable candles. What we do is to build Hubble diagrams like this. And you note that here there's scatter in these guys. Now the scatter comes from three different components. From two different components. So if you had standard candles in a perfect, unperturbed FRW universe, what you would be measuring is just mu zero, the average. Now, if you take into account the fact that these are standardizable candle, not standard candle, then you have an intrinsic component, an intrinsic variation, which is this delta mu I. Plus, if you add the fact that your universe is not homogeneous, but you are observing through an inhomogeneous universe, then you have a second component that is due to lensing. Now, this component due to lensing is highly non-Gaussian. Most of the supernovae are slightly demagnified. A few of them are strongly magnified. You can use this to actually measure how clumpy your universe is. And this is a simulation that we did using 2000 supernovae. This was a project that is before SNAP. And these are the constraints that you get on omega matter and C wave. By the way, showing you that if you use the wrong PDF for the fluctuation in delta mu induced by lensing, you are screwing up your measurement of sigma f. You are not screwing up your measurement of omega matter, by the way. And the reason for that is that omega matter is determined by mu zero, which is the average value of the distance modulus. The added bonus is that, first of all, this information comes for free. It's just in the supernova. You don't need to build any other experiment. You just need to analyze your data.
When you say Gaussian, you mean you approximate the lensing as Gaussian, or what is it like Gaussian?
I mean that this is the PDF for delta mu, cosmological. You can actually
okay,
from the sorry.
I understand that. Okay. So you approximate kappa as Gaussian.
More or less. You can build it. Yes, you approximate kappa as a Gaussian, and then you calculate the PDF for the delta mu cross. Okay. So this gives you an independent way of measuring similarities. This is independent from any other large scale structure probes. Okay, so I talked about lensing as a source of information. Lensing also acts as noise. One thing that I did was to see how it acts on measurement of baryon oscillations. As I was saying before, it acts in two ways, smoothing and magnification bias. It's not a strong modification. It smooths out the peak of baryon oscillations by about 5%. Sorry, 0.5%. So baryon oscillations are standard rulers, are robust standard rulers. The interesting thing was that actually smoothing depends only on the fact that photon travel is geodesic. So people have been lensing of galaxies, IV lensing of galaxies. benzene or CMP or lasers, but actually it's all the same thing. I mean, it's always photon parallel geodesics. So actually it was straightforward to generalize this to any redshift and any sort of different thing you're looking at, like 21 centimeter surface, for instance, where measurement of binary oscillation then are affected by at 1.5% level. And here we got again the CMB, just to see that our method worked. Magnification bias, on the other hand, acts only on point sources. And we looked also not only at pair of galaxies, but also at frequent functions. So measurement of non-Gaussianity through galaxy frequent function. And actually for three-point function, it can, depending on the configuration of your triangle, it can actually have a sizable effect between 1, 2, 5, 6, 7%. So, okay, I'm at the conclusion, slightly over time, but not too much, hopefully. Apologies to the expert. I have covered a lot of ground, and certainly I didn't do justice to this field. These fields are, you know, wonderful in by themselves. But what can I do? Data from current and near future experiments may create these the most exciting times for cosmology, especially if you are looking at dark matter under many different ways, you know, many different angles. Thank you for your time.
Alberto will be here today and tomorrow, and we can take him to dinner today around 6:30. Questions?
I missed the lens museum, the data from the CMB is really not good. Is this just from the temperature? Is this from polarization?
No, polarization.
Oh, from polarization. Yeah. Okay. So you're looking at B modes.
E modes. You can already do it with E modes. I'm not sure you need B modes for that.
But you're going to make B modes.
That's B-modes. True.
I think E modes primordial. Yeah, so how do you know if they're not primordial emotes that you look
at? But there's non-Gaussianity in the emotes.
Well, actually, depending, I mean, these, okay. Quadratic estimators that you're using to measure what is doing the lensing, mm-hmm. you can have different, so depending on the secondary that you want to look at, you can combine them in different ways to measure different secondaries. It's actually something very
okay. But it's sort of roughly non-Gaussianity in the emotes that you're measuring from the lens. And I'm just wondering how you separate it from the original, whatever original polarization you had there.
Yeah, I would suspect so, but I'm not the expert on time.
So I guess the short answer to that is that in Gaussian statistics, modes are uncorrelated. But if you lens them, then different modes become correlated.
Okay.
And then if you look at correlation of different modes, then you can extract them. And okay. you can do it with temperature.
Okay. So it's sort of a 3-point statistic.
Yeah. I think it's more like a 4-point.
It's a 4-point,
yeah.
Okay. But it's going to be that good from time.
Yeah.
Wow.
Okay.
That's a surprise.
Question? John?
Make sure a picture of the bullet cluster.
Sorry? You want the picture of the bullet cluster?
No, I know what it looks like.
I think you have to go back.
We didn't actually discuss it. But,
yeah, it's on the first, second slide. It's a while.
So what about the time?
Yes.
Yeah, well, since we went sitting away from it, we've all seen the picture. There's another merging of clusters called Hippo 520.
Is that the train wreck?
August FJ 2007.
Uh-huh.
And it shows the opposite of the train wreck.
Yeah.
So whenever people show this picture, I have to put it on my hand and say, look at, I call it the anti-bullet cluster.
Is that the one that without the train wreck?
Yes.
Yes, okay. Now, I had a slightly different presentation. That.
So you do.
I'm aware of that.
Are you aware of the problem?
Yes.
Good. Thank you.
Other questions? If not, let's thank Thank you so much for coming on. That's it, and many others we can have.